the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, and this week I have a fascinating interview with Nick Carter from Castle Island Ventures, but firstly I have a message from my sponsors. So first up is Hedera Hashgraph, who will be hosting an international hackathon starting this Monday, October the 15th. Winners will be awarded a combination of cash and Hedera tokens and the potential to have their project incubated and deployed on the Hedera Hashgraph public network. The global winning team will be awarded $50,000. First place regional winning team will get $10,000 and second place $7,000 and a third place of $3,000. Very exciting stuff there. The Hedera 18 hackathon is the first global decentralized Hashgraph hackathon, bringing together developers from all around the world, and will be hosted in Dallas, San Francisco, London, Paris, Tel Aviv, Moscow, Bangalore, and Singapore. This two-day hackathon starts at 8 a.m. local time to each region and finishes at 6:30 p.m. the following day. Featuring teams of up to 10 people, each team will work on building next-generation decentralized applications that showcase the power of Hedera Hashgraph's practical micropayment functionality. For more information and to see if there's an eligible city near you, visit www.hedera18.com/hackathon. That is www.hedera18.com/hackathon. And next up, my regular sponsor, BlockFi. They can help you use your cryptocurrencies without having to sell. If you're trying to buy a house, maybe you want to fund a business or even pay off your taxes, you might be faced with the choice of selling your crypto. But with BlockFi, you can keep your crypto and still pay for those outgoings with a crypto-backed loan. You can use your Bitcoin or Ether and get USD funded directly to your bank account. And with loan sizes ranging from $2,000 to $10 million, BlockFi is perfect for supporting financial goals of any size. And they have created a special offer to the listeners of my podcast. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral for loans under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000, and applying takes less than 2 minutes. Okay, this week's guest, Nick Carter. If you don't know him and you didn't see his presentation from Honey Badger Conference, then I recommend you go and check it out. I've included a link to it in the show notes. After I watched it and reading about the investment thesis of Castle Island, how they make equity investments in companies building on public blockchains, mainly Bitcoin, I thought Nick would make for an interesting interview. And also, if you haven't read the Unisquare Ventures article this week on the myth of the infrastructure phase, then I recommend you do. I've included a link to that in the show notes as well. It was good timing, as I had a whole bunch of things I was struggling with, things I wanted to ask Nick. Being a skeptic, I thought he would be a good person to run these by. We cover a lot. We go through the obsession with blockchains, on-chain governance, and where it's relevant, and is the Web3 stack really a thing? Will we have this future web stack built on a decentralized infrastructure? We also touch on Bitcoin. I asked Nick about the realized cap measure he presented on at Honey Badger. We talk about mining centralization, and we also talk about the risks of base chain privacy with Bitcoin. A couple of updates from me. You may have seen me mention it on Twitter or a new show in your feed. I have allowed the Free Ross campaign to distribute their mini-series Railroaded via my podcast. Obviously, the story of Ross Ulbricht is important to me, and I want to help them in any way I can. So please do listen, please do share it out, and please do sign the petition if you haven't. There's a whole bunch of information about the campaign in the episode show notes, and I've created a page for the series on my website. So if you head over to www.whatbitcoindid.com/railroaded, you can find out more information. Also, I've been going back to my advertising roots. I've been writing a few pieces about that. If you go to my Medium page, you will see there's a couple of articles. One is titled "We Need to Talk About Crypto Marketing," and one is talking about the decentralized threat to advertising. I'm just trying to have a look at the cross-section between advertising and decentralized technologies and a private web. So please take a look. Let me know if you've got any questions. I'm working on a marketing blueprint for the private web. If you want to help, give me a shout. And lastly, I'm going to be moving to a twice a week show soon. I've got a whole bunch of interviews lined up, so going to be pretty busy, but I hope you all enjoy that. Okay, so please support the show. There's a bunch of things you can do. Firstly, you can become a patron. I've got 19 now. I'm so grateful for this. I kind of had this target, which if I hit, I would go to a twice weekly show, but I'm just going to do it now anyway. But patrons help. So if you're interested in supporting the show, if you want to get the shows early, I do release them early to patrons. And if you want to help me start preparing some of the frameworks, then head over to www.patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. And please give me a shout if you have any questions. You can leave me a review on iTunes. If you think I deserve 5 stars, that is excellent. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I found out that actually helps with your listings. I didn't know that. You can follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Medium, I'm at What Bitcoin Did on everything. You can check out my website at www.whatbitcoindid.com. I'm trying to make that as useful as possible. You can sign up to my newsletter. 2 emails a week at the moment. You get one about the show, and you get another one which is a summary of all the other best podcasts I find in the space. And you can share this show out with your friends and family. Okay, I'll shut up now. On to the interview with Nick. I hope you enjoy it. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. I pretty much respond to anyone, and my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Good evening, Nick. Thank you for agreeing to come on the podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
I've listened to a couple of your previous interviews and the origin stories out there, so I'll share that in the show notes and I won't cover it again. But I would like to know a little bit about Castle Ventures. Can you give me the origin story of Castle Ventures and then also talk to me about your investment thesis?
Sure. Yeah, I'm glad you're sparing your listeners my very dull origin story. So we'll cut right to the chase. Castle Island is a place in South Boston. It is not a castle and it's not an island. In that respect, the fact that we're a quote-unquote blockchain VC fund is very fitting because neither I nor my partner Matt like the word blockchain. And we try and be very different from the other funds. So we like the contradiction there. We spun out of Fidelity. Matt created a crypto asset fund at Fidelity in 2017, a balance sheet fund, and hired me as an analyst to cover public blockchains. And it was like an equity research style position. And we wanted to be more entrepreneurial and kind of strike out on our own. And we also wanted to target equity and operating businesses instead of tokens or crypto assets specifically. We felt that the opportunity really was in equity in businesses building on top of public blockchains, like Bitcoin, obviously, you know, one of our key targets there, or sort of blockchain agnostic financial infrastructure type thing, which has become extremely hackneyed to say these days. It's become much more popular as of late, to our chagrin. But yeah, so we left Fidelity earlier, mid-2018. We've been active for a few months now, closed our fundraise and started deploying capital. And we are a seed stage fund, and we look to support entrepreneurs that, you know, share our state of mind and are building promising conventional businesses rather than doing ICOs or tokens or any sort of arcane token economic models.
And therefore, you're also avoiding the volatility and ridiculous nature of token valuations and some of the, because we've seen some quite big falls for funds this year. I think Pantera just recorded like a 72% fall this year. I guess you don't have to worry about that so much.
Well, we haven't had the chance to have a massive drawdown in assets because we haven't really deployed yet. But venture is kind of a boom or bust business by its very nature. So I, you know, expect volatility. But you wouldn't be able to benchmark our positions in real time because they're kind of illiquid by their very nature.
And can you talk about any of the companies you've invested in?
Sure. Yeah. So we've made four investments. One of them is a local data company, Flipside Crypto, run by a friend of ours, Dave Balter. They are doing a number of things, but among them is kind of data services built for to sort of clarify and bring some, yeah, essentially clarity to these markets, potentially for end users. It's kind of like a B2B business. Well, I mean, it's still very early stage, so we'll see what happens there. A really exciting company we're very proud to back is Casa HODL, the Bitcoin custody business run by Jeremy Welsh, doing extremely exciting stuff there. And we also just closed an investment in this company called Dust Identity, which is, in my view, kind of the missing link between the physical and the digital. I know everyone always says a lot of those blockchain like registry companies where you can register art, for instance, on the blockchain, that doesn't make any sense because I could claim to be the owner of the Mona Lisa, right? So Dust is a company that takes industrial diamonds and repurposes them, so waste diamonds, essentially, so like really tiny ground-up particles, suspends them in kind of an epoxy solution, and you can paint like a square millimeter of this solution onto a physical object. It dries, and then that diamond configuration essentially acts as a fingerprint, which cannot be easily faked. The bit space is something like 2 to the power of 260. So it's a very, very precise fingerprint. And then what you do then is you take that fingerprint and you can insert it into any public blockchain you like, you know, maybe using open timestamps or something. And then you can prove that that is the same. The set of things you can prove is kind of limited, but you can at least reason about these things and be like, look, this like high value electronic part is the same one today that, you know, it was registered a year ago. So it's essentially a much better barcode. And the idea is to kind of link the physical and the digital. So that's the kind of stuff we really like. It's not necessarily a blockchain investment, but it ties in neatly to public blockchains.
Yeah, CASA is very interesting. I've had Jameson Lopp on the podcast twice. I think it's a very interesting project. I've also bought a Lightning node. Do you have a Lightning node?
You know, they didn't send us one. Jeremy, if you're listening, we'd love a CASA Lightning node.
I think there's a big backlog now. I think December's when mine is coming.
We love CASA. They're doing amazing stuff, have tons of interesting stuff in the pipeline, already pushing the envelope. You know, young company, but already with the Lightning node side of things, I think they're one of the most exciting companies in Bitcoin today.
So listen, you know, I watched your presentation at the Honey Badger conference in Riga, and I thought it was great. And it would be very easy just to start talking to you about Bitcoin. But I've also gone on my own kind of journey of learning. And I find there's this thing where the more you learn about Bitcoin, the more you realize some of the other projects don't make sense. And I kind of want to talk about some of that and get some of your opinions on it, because I think you're probably further ahead of me and you probably articulate things better than me and you've probably got a lot more knowledge. So what I don't understand is why there are so many seemingly smart people working on so many projects that don't seem to make sense. I can't get my head around it. And I was reading your article on blockchains. And what I thought was quite interesting is, I've got your quote here. I believe in 5 to 10 years, we will look back at the popularity on blockchains and be slightly embarrassed. And what I thought was quite interesting is what you put into that article was talked about the reason the blockchain exists. The blockchain exists as a reason to stop governments closing it down. Do you know the article I'm referring to?
Yeah.
So why do you think there is this such fascination with blockchains? And can you, or are there any examples of blockchains outside of Bitcoin that you do think are relevant and you do think are interesting?
Yeah, I guess interesting and potentially valuable are different concepts. So I am interested by dozens of alternative blockchains or data structures or things that are similar to Bitcoin in some way. I don't even know if blockchain is the right word. I hate that word. But, you know, how many of them I think are going to actually arrive at some sustainable long-term value where people treat them as a valuable instrument, a quasi-equity-like or commodity-like instrument that stores billions of dollars in value. I haven't really seen the case made for anything other than probably Bitcoin right now that I believe in. So I'm definitely, you know, on the more skeptical side of things. I'm closer to a no-coiner than a multi-coiner, right? I believe in right now is only one, really, realistically speaking, one large public blockchain that I think will actually credibly retain significant amounts of value for the foreseeable future. And I struggle to see how any of these other things will accumulate value. But to answer your question, you know, why are blockchains so popular? I do think that this whole industry has been warped by the Bitcoin experience, which is not just generational, but whatever a larger, more zoomed out version of generational is. An event that happens once in every 100 years or so, which is people begin to lose faith in the global reserve currency. Right now it's a dollar. And start to question, do things always have to be like this? Do we always need to live in this kind of regime? Is the global hegemon as powerful as we thought they were? Are things going to change? And, you know, of course, the previous time that occurred was around World War I, when the British Empire was displaced and the US kind of stepped in and the pound was obsoleted as the global reserve currency and the dollar kind of stepped in there. I think we're in the midst of a shift like that. I don't think we've identified what the next asset is, but I think Bitcoin kind of has the potential to at least fill part of that niche. And since we're in this monetization event for Bitcoin, obviously the returns have been absolutely insane, and everyone witnessed this. And this completely colored their perception. And they decided, wow, whatever the essence of Bitcoin is, I need to distill that and put that in a bottle and apply it to my thing. And if I can do that, well, if I can only do that half as well as Bitcoin, I'll have half the returns, right? But that, to me, is a fundamentally fallacious way to reason. And more to the point, I think most people have misunderstood what the essence of Bitcoin is and misunderstood the likelihood of it being repeated as a monetization event. And actually, probably Ethereum, you know, the success of Ethereum is also fuel to the fire here, because people thought, well, Bitcoin can be repeated. Look at Ethereum. And then that line of reasoning was applied to dozens and dozens of other projects. But the point I make in the article is, blockchain is a word that refers to the data structure. In my view, the data structure is only a tiny part of what makes Bitcoin such an elegant system. The other part is the predefined intersubjective consensus that we all abide by, the kind of P2P network governance that Pierre Richard talks about, the hardness, the difficulty of being a validator, which makes the monetary economics kind of fair, which means that miners don't necessarily have a huge advantage in the system. They can't really perform seniorage because it's very costly for them to propose blocks and so on. Those are all things that are missed out when you reduce Bitcoin to just the notion of a blockchain. So, you know, I like to kind of assume that people generally have good intentions and they're just sort of a little bit misled or maybe a little bit confused. I am puzzled every single day of my life by the willingness of entrepreneurs or programmers to spend so much time on things that will obviously fail in the long term. And just today we're seeing news about the hundreds and hundreds of SEC subpoenas to ICOs go out. I think virtually every ICO is going to end in tears. And people have put thousands of hours and they've put the best of intentions into their ICOs, but they're pretty much going to be defunct in 12 to 18 months' time for the most part. So I do talk to entrepreneurs every day that tell me, well, why am I even bothering with a equity raise when I could just do an ICO and raise a ton of money and have it be non-dilutive financing? And I'm rambling a little bit here, but I think the 2015 to 17 kind of ICO mania left this idea in a lot of heads of founders that they didn't need to bother with equity anymore. They could just go for the easy way out. And unfortunately, lots of people went for that. And now they're stuck building these blockchains that'll probably never come to fruition. But yeah, it is really, I don't actually have a good answer. It's one of the abiding mysteries that we're going to be grappling with for years and years. Why did blockchain, the notion of a blockchain, you know, on its own become so popular? And why did we think that it could be applied to every conceivable problem?
I guess a combination of entrepreneurial spirit, a little bit of greed, probably some people, like you said, with good intentions. I know when I first started investing, I couldn't really tell the difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum too much. They both seemed interesting. I had no background in monetary policy or economics. I worked in advertising. It all kind of seemed interesting, and only in doing 10 months of podcasts and reading endless articles, preparing for interviews, some of it starting to make sense. And I think perhaps people just don't realize, they don't have maybe the educational background of someone like your Pierre, or haven't spent the time dedicated to learning about it. So they live in this fallacy with this belief that this, it can be repeated, and only when it does fail will they realize.
Well, I don't want to label people that disagree with me as fallacious. I think there's a lot of different ways to disagree with me. So things I think are acceptable beliefs to hold are that maybe we'll have 5 or 6 major public blockchains that succeed and coexist and interoperate, or maybe the thing that matters the most with a programmable money is not the money side, but the programmability side, in which case you might be more of an Ethereum believer. Or maybe you believe that the state really does have the power to shut down these things, in which case you'd be averse to the whole system. So I think there are lots and lots of very reasonable ways to disagree with me. However, I do think that it's like sort of unforgivable to kind of steal Satoshi's verbiage, you know, like his words, like the blockchain, and apply it to things that have absolutely nothing in common with Bitcoin in any reasonable way whatsoever, and use that as marketing and PR, which is what a lot of corporations are kind of doing cynically. And that's part of the reason why I wrote that article. Like, if you want to build a ledger with certain immutability or reliability characteristics, go ahead. But those things don't look anything like Bitcoin, really. So why would you borrow the blockchain for your branding? It doesn't make sense to me. I would just prefer that they were more honest about the things they were building.
Probably for cynical reasons. It did make me laugh with the strawberry provenance on the blockchain, because I was looking at thinking, yeah, I understand why they think it's a reason, but it doesn't make any difference because it's just a database record in the end.
That IBM essentially controls entirely. And even if they were to create a consortium database or something, that is interesting and like very useful in many cases, right? That's kind of what Swift is, and that's like how Visa began. So that is very useful if you want to have a consortium that's co-managed by lots of different institutions that don't necessarily trust each other but trust the rules of the system. But you don't have an open validator set in that context. So you don't really need to go for the trade-offs that a Bitcoin does. So yeah, that was the point I was making in the article.
Did you read the Union Square Ventures article about the myth of the infrastructure phase that came out this week?
Certainly did, yeah.
I tell you what I found very interesting about the article is that it was almost like saying Bitcoin has done the right thing. If you read the article, you can then pretty much apply what they're saying to what's happened with Bitcoin is people are building apps, are interfacing with the protocol, and the protocol is coming under strain. Therefore, upgrades are proposed for the protocol and the developers work on them. And the infrastructure upgrades tend to be a reflection of what's being built. Whereas you then look at everything else and you look at some of the funds of what they're investing in, and it's all infrastructure without the apps to support it.
That article was, I thought it was actually fairly well done. I think I publicly took exception to the fact that they mostly focused on Ethereum and didn't touch on Bitcoin, which I thought was maybe a little bit unfair. But yeah, maybe the infrastructure application distinction is a little bit arbitrary. So I probably roughly agree with their thesis. And we like to say we're in the infrastructure phase or the application phase, but Bitcoin is going to be in the infrastructure phase for like the next 15 years, probably. We're nowhere near the final product. And same with Ethereum. Ethereum is, you know, moving to 2.0. So I'm still a little bit hesitant about a lot of the applications of quote-unquote blockchain or public blockchains. I haven't seen a ton of evidence that there are end-user applications that work, that make sense, aside from the core application, which is saving money and transmitting money, which has been done very well by applications or intermediaries like Coinbase or Xapo or Square for the last few years. So if you consider using Bitcoin as a bank to be an application, then that is an application that has been very successful. And that is what enabled Bitcoin to proliferate so much in the last couple of years. But if by application you mean a decentralized gambling or a decentralized Uber or something on the blockchain, then yeah, we're light years away from that. And I don't even know if those applications will ever come to exist. I'm not sure there's enough demand for them.
It's quite interesting. So I was listening to Laura Shin's interview with Barry Silbert today, and he said he doesn't ever see a need for a decentralized Uber or a decentralized Twitter. The Uber example he gave was that because it's centralized, he trusts that a car will come and he would trust that he's got recourse should something go wrong. Whereas in a decentralized environment, the design is probably more around a fairer distribution of wages or decision making, but you lose that centralized body to talk to if you have a problem. I buy what he says there.
Yeah, I fully agreed on that point. I'm not even sure Bitcoin does what it does. Maybe the central conceit of the 2017 ICO bubble really was this idea that we could replace markets, corporations with markets, with the blockchains providing the intermediation there. We don't want things to be trustless in our everyday lives. That's kind of an insane state of nature kind of way to be, which is very Hobbesian and unpleasant, I think. And even Bitcoin itself is not trustless. It just tries to alter the nature of trust between individuals and maybe reduce the requirements that we depend on trust. But I mean, it's not purely trustless. So I'm not sure introducing a blockchain makes anything cheaper. I'm not sure it introduces efficiencies anywhere. And with an Uber, it's a two-sided market, of course, but there's a reason that you have an intermediary sitting in the middle of that. It kind of does authentication. It does the background checks on the drivers. You know, it actually manages the customer base as well. If they're a nasty customer, they get kicked out of the service. And it does the payment processing and everything. So there's a very good reason that why we have a corporation sitting in the middle of that market. Same with Airbnb. So when you try and decentralize all these services, you run into issues of identity, vetting the entities in that market. And all those things would be solved if you just ended up relying on a trusted third party. And I think this isn't exactly a new thing to say, but money might be the only case where you desperately need to radically decentralize the set of people that can create it and the set of people that have influence over the creation schedule and so on. And perhaps those very expensive trade-offs are not required for other contexts.
So another area I really struggle with, and I've been trying to get my head around it, is governance projects, on-chain governance. The 200 odd million raised by Tezos. I can't understand where large real-world applications exist for on-chain governance. And the more I read about it, the more I... Like, there's this quote from Nick Szabo I read about it. He said, "It's too hopelessly a broad term. It can be made to mean anything. Its use doesn't shed any light on the actual residual human decision-making that is needed." I'm really struggling with governance projects, more so than anything else.
Yeah, I definitely resonate with the Szabo quote. There's two words that I've launched full broadside attacks on, and they've been blockchain and governance. And I gave a talk at the Zcash convention about why I think blockchain governance is kind of a nonsense topic. Full disclosure, I participated in the Tezos token sale personally. That's the one and only. That's because I wanted to find out what it was like to be involved in one of those things. And it was obviously a disaster because it was like a year until I got my funds and, you know, all that nonsense. But I sent half a Bitcoin to that token sale. So if you want to call me a shitcoiner, you know, there's your pretext. There you go.
You've now confessed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so sometimes this industry feels like a huge cargo cult, right? It feels like people with no groundings in the topics that they are self-professed expert on, opining on things that they have no business kind of getting involved in, and probably governance being designed by computer scientists when it is a body of work that it should probably be assigned to the political philosophy, I think is a typical example of that. It feels like an extreme cargo cult to me. In particular, the notion that EOS, for instance, had, just to pick an example, had like better governance than Bitcoin. To me, that just smacks of Project never really understanding Bitcoin's governance model, because it takes a lot of time to understand. It's difficult. And I would say that the on-chain governance kind of phase was one grounded in a misunderstanding of why we even created blockchains in the first place. And the difficulties of managing relationships between thousands and thousands of dispersed people worldwide. And there will be reckonings with all of these projects that have on-chain governance or votes built in. And actually, if you look carefully, you'll see that they've already had all these various different struggles that are a function of the fact that they introduced these sort of voting mechanisms. So like Dash, for instance, if you have a central pot of money, which can be assigned by a plutocratic vote of a few token holders, you then have a situation where you have kind of professional siphoners that just play politics and get close to the people assigning votes in that system, and at a relatively little cost can extract money from that fund. And if you look carefully at the dynamics for any project where there is a fund, you'll see that most of the outflow from that fund is going to a fairly small set of individuals. So you haven't solved anything in that case. I mean, you might claim that you're a more successful project because you have the ability to pay for marketing and so on, but all you've achieved is just a situation where by proximity to the developers or the people that have a lot of power in that system, you're able to enrich yourself, which in my view is a complete failure. So I don't think quote-unquote on-chain governance solves very much, and it introduces a new breed of like kind of exotic problems. And the reason that a system like Bitcoin is made to be so difficult to change is because it's a really high-stakes system. And nobody should have the right to apportion themselves an unfair percentage of that currency. And Satoshi himself, you know, threw away his right to be apportioned a disproportionate percentage. I mean, assuming you believe that he doesn't intend on using his Bitcoins. And one thing that I think is different between Bitcoin and other protocols is that the core developers of Bitcoin do not have the ability to assign themselves an unfair or larger fraction of Bitcoin than everyone else. But the core developers of protocols with on-chain governance plus shared pools of tokens that are controlled by the developers do have the ability to do that. So that's where I would say the key difference lies. And I'd say the governance challenges that Bitcoin has are challenges that every project has to grapple with, and introducing a vote doesn't fix that.
What I'm struggling with these governance projects as well, so Tezos might have invested a huge amount of developer resource into building their on-chain governance systems, but like in my simple mind, where is the real use case here? Like where does this go from being a piece of software to something that is widely used? I can't think of myself of a use case apart from a posh voting system.
Well, I guess if you think of blockchains as constitutions, the ability for that constitution to amend itself is kind of core, because successful ones need to be adaptable and so on. So that's the intuition there. but it took us a really long time to find a successful federal republic model. It took humanity like millennia of civilization to strike upon the one that worked. I mean, I'd say the U.S. Constitution is probably one of the first very successful models. And even that one is kind of facing challenges now. So I find it unlikely that the first sort of on-chain governance model is the one that works.
On-chain governance seems to be designed around more democratic voting, whereas sometimes in life we need leadership or decision-making to come from a single person or a small group of people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, open source projects have typically a technocratic elite that make decisions, and it's typically a small group of individuals. And that mirrors the way that very successful states like Singapore operate. Small, nimble, quick-rising, high-growth states. And we don't even have a democracy in an on-chain governance context because we don't have the ability to kind of KYC people, really, and have a one-man, one-vote situation. Instead, it's a one-token, one-vote. So you just have a plutocracy in that case. And I think most people would agree plutocracy is bad. And with on-chain votes, you also have the ability to obscure the real nexus of power. So if you kind of scrutinize the EOS votes, you have to do a lot of like analytical work to determine who is voting for whom. And then you have things like this leaked spreadsheet that circulates that shows like, oh, we have an agreement to vote for this person if you vote for us, and you get these quid pro quo dynamics. If you have a very open and transparent system, you probably don't have to grapple with that. But I think on-chain is often a pretext for these same hyper-concentrated power structures to manifest themselves, proclaim themselves to be decentralized or to be following a fair protocol.
See, it was quite funny. It was only after watching House of Cards that I got a better understanding of how US politics work, even though obviously it's dramatized for TV. I couldn't help but feel that when I saw the EOS, it was the EOS spreadsheet that came out, right? You vote for me, I vote for you.
Yeah.
It felt very much like what I'd seen in House of Cards. You vote for me, I vote for you. And therefore, nothing had really been solved. The exact same problems had been put online into a blockchain.
And it's not like we didn't warn about this. I mean, that was really my main objection to EOS, is that you would get cartelization, collusion, a calcification of the block producer set. You wouldn't get enough block producer churn. I actually wrote up a long critique, which I didn't publish, which is kind of useless for everyone. And you get politics. And this is really the reason why we invented proof of work. Well, not me, but Satoshi and pals. And the reason is because it makes it extremely transparent who has power in that system. It's not without its drawbacks, but there is absolutely no concept of political clout in that system. It's just you have to apportion energy to the protocol in order to have some sort of say in validation. And even then, you're super disempowered because the protocol kind of reigns supreme. And the users, if they want, as we learned with UASF, can make a credible threat to kind of whisk it out from under your feet. So that's precisely why proof of work was invented. And to everyone that kind of says, oh, it's too costly, the externalities are too severe, well, I would invite them to contemplate the alternative, which is either a hyper-concentrated system where you just allocate power to a single mint or a single arbitrator, or a political system where the same work occurs, but it's just obscured and it typically works through the lens of politics, which is worse for everybody else. I much prefer transparency over politics, essentially, and that's why Bitcoin appeals to me.
Okay, and then the last thing on my list that I've been looking at myself again recently is the Web3 stack. So the first time I came across this was an article by Carl Samani from Multicoin, and then I saw a slightly different take on it from Amber at Crypto Springs. I'm trying to understand this vision of a Web3 stack, which is a decentralized privacy web stack. I just can't see it happening myself. It feels like there won't be this decentralized Web3 stack. The technologies of decentralization and privacy will just integrate within the current web stack. And I'm really struggling to see why people have this vision of all these technologies all playing out to create this highly decentralized experience that exists either separate from, as a separate experience, or as something which is a successor to what we have now.
Yeah, I haven't looked deeply at either of those proposals. I am fairly skeptical of the whole Web3 movement. My view on this is that the main problem that needs to be solved is everybody surrendering their data to these silos controlled by a few monopolists like Google or Amazon or Apple. And instead, we need a restoration of our own sovereign data. There's a lot of kind of conceptual challenges that need to be met before we can solve that problem. So, yeah, I'm not trying to know enough about the Web3 kind of theme to opine deeply on it. But, yeah, I think we have two key problems in the world right now within our small, narrow industry, one of which is building out a decentralized monetary system that can't be perverted easily. And the other one is building out a self-sovereign data system. And I think it's a little bit too early to be building out these models of stacks in a super confident way and assuming everything will interoperate and play nicely together, and also assuming that all these projects will succeed and realize the vision. A lot of it feels just probably too speculative, too early. And my view typically is that this stuff takes a lot longer than we expect. It's taken Bitcoin 10 full years to sort of work the way we expected it to for the two-layer system to actually meaningfully work. And it'll probably take another 10 years before I think we're satisfied with it, at least. It's kind of like, you know, if we're in like 1993 and we're saying, well, we're going to have video messaging soon and we're going to be able to play poker together in World of Warcraft and so on. I mean, it's very fun to reason about this stuff, but probably too early.
So the conclusion I came to, I was looking at it from a communications angle. The conclusion I came to, it is more about privacy and data. And then I started taking a look at the work that Tim Berners-Lee's doing with Inrupt. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I like that a lot, actually. I mean, the kind of projects I like are ones that align with the idea that I just laid out, and those would be things like Blockstack or Urbit, for instance. I don't know if either of those will succeed, but that's kind of the broad thrust that I'm... Or even something like Mastodon, which replaces the centralized model of social media with a federated model. It's not perfect, but that's kind of the world I want to gravitate towards.
Are you using Mastodon?
Yeah, there's a Bitcoin instance I'm on there.
I looked at it and I just kind of had this, I kind of imagined it would be kind of a ghost town, but I might have to go and check that out after this. Okay, I know you've probably talked about this a bit recently, but I did really enjoy your presentation at Honey Badger and your talk on Bitcoin as an economic system. Can we talk a little bit about that? Can you tell me firstly where it came from, kind of the idea, the research, and then I think you should probably tell people about the conclusions you came to. You had the proposal for the realized cap and then the proposal for Bitcoin density, right?
Yeah, so my talk was a huge mess because it was a big brain dump of concepts that I'd been thinking about for the previous 6 months and I hadn't had the opportunity to share it with anyone really. And so I was like, I'm going to try and pack like 15 concepts that I've been mulling over into a single 20-minute talk and see how people deal with that. And so then it's just a ton of not that related concepts just like bundled in together.
Well, I thought realized cap made a lot of sense. That came through very clearly to me. Actually, I'll tell you the two things that came through very clearly to me. Realized cap, and I think the most important thing about realized cap is not how it reset the value of Bitcoin, is how it proportionally reset the value of everything else compared to Bitcoin. Therefore, you got a better understanding of the value of everything compared to each other rather than the value of Bitcoin on its own.
Fully agreed. Yeah, that's also my takeaway from realized cap.
And then when you start looking at the network, the thing I took away from that most of all was when you talked about how we have to be tough on the exchanges who are essentially guardians of our systems and protocols. So let's talk about realized cap. Tell me where realized cap came from, the process you went through to get to it.
Yes, I will. Full disclosure, it was not my idea. It wasn't my idea. So stop attributing it to me. Pierre Richard came up with it. He asked me on Telegram if I could devise it for him. And I actually couldn't. I'm just the middleman on this one. And then I went to Antoine. I'm like, maybe Antoine can do this. I mean, I thought about it for like a month or so. And then I asked Antoine de Calvez. And he was like, yeah, I can do it. And he whipped it up in like 15 minutes. It was amazing. He's a magician. So then the real work there, I guess, aside from devising the actual data set, was explaining it and trying to make sense of it. So that was my sort of small contribution. But the idea was, I hate it when... And the Bitcoin Cash and the Bitcoin Private case studies really make this very clear. I don't like it when projects play the market cap game. I've been banging on for a while about this concept of using CoinMarketCap as branding for your project, you know, trying to get like a vanity spot high up there on CoinMarketCap. And one thing that I identified was gaming that metric by playing the market gap game. You airdrop to kind of larger chain, and then almost none of that airdropped is claimed in the case of Bitcoin Private. And then it looks like your market cap's 2 billion when in fact only 5% of those coins are liquid. So it makes absolutely zero sense. So you have a super low float, and it makes zero sense to call that whole thing the market cap. So that was kind of the conceptual inspiration. And that was the point I was trying to make, is that we have this rich set of on-chain data. Why are we not using that to take an empirical view of the actual liquid cap, right? The circulating cap. And then realized cap automates that whole process, because you know, you could do this in an idiosyncratic way. You could be like, well, there looks like there's like X many million Bitcoin caches are active and X many million Z caches are active. But using realized cap just like kind of standardizes the whole thing. And with Coinmetrics, I'll eventually put out realized cap real-time data for all of the UTXO chains at least.
It would be interesting to look at the Bitcoin dominance with realized cap. I imagine it'd be quite a bit higher.
I don't know. You get interesting results. I'm not sure realized cap is actually that valid for some smaller chains that don't have a lot of turnover, because you kind of need a lot of turnover for it to make sense and be reactive. And I am a little bit wary of just engineering a bunch of weird metrics for the sake of it. So that's always kind of top of mind for me. I don't want to just create new nonsense metrics for the sake of it. But realized cap did have a good reception, and I'm going to keep exploring it.
Okay, great. And then you started looking at the Bitcoin network, and you realized from your analysis that most of the transactions are between exchanges, or the large transactions anyway. So they're acting as, I think it's Andreas who was calling exchanges banks at one point as well, but they're acting like banks. They're using it as a settlement layer. So, and you said they're essentially, therefore, they've become the stewards of Bitcoin, and we need to be tough on them.
Yeah, so I mean, have you seen The Lord of the Rings?
A while back.
So you know how Denethor, well, maybe you won't know, but so Denethor, you know, is the steward of Gondor. He was not born into being the king of Gondor, because that's Aragorn, right? And his bloodline. But Denethor was appointed the steward, and he kind of did a pretty bad job of running Gondor, right? He didn't make sense of the threat from Mordor, and then eventually he lit himself on fire and threw himself off the top of Minas Tirith, right? So that's kind of how I think about large exchanges, right? They often do a pretty awful job of taking care of the blockchain that we kind of entrust to them, because there's a very limited set of block space, and they use it and they derive a huge economic benefit from using it, right? And what we need to do as users is to police them and make sure that they're behaving properly. And if they're not, we should light them on fire and throw them off the top of Minas Tirith, because they are both the thing that makes Bitcoin work functionally as a system that can onboard millions of people as opposed to just hundreds of thousands. But if they misbehave, they're doing a terrible job. And it's up to Bitcoiners to hold them accountable, because no one else will. So that's why I talk about exchanges as the stewards of Bitcoin.
How do we hold them accountable, though?
Well, there's a website, OneSegwit, which is pretty funny, and it just like popularizes exchanges that implement SegWit. I mean, it already happens, you know, people scream at Coinbase, like, implement SegWit, start batching. Those are very basic things you can do, and they radically enhance Bitcoin's capacity, you know. Today, if exchanges batched, we could fit probably 2 million payments a day in the Bitcoin system, as opposed to 300,000 transactions, right? So you can get a lot more out of Bitcoin, especially with batching, which is a huge scalability win. And if you are making tons and tons of payments a day, you can batch. So you can achieve a really good level of scalability just by using very common sense methods.
So looking forward, you've talked about Bitcoin having a chance, or a significant chance, of being a global reserve currency. What do you think is missing, and what do you think the next phases of the infrastructure within Bitcoin do you think is required to take us there?
So it took us a while, but we are now entering the kind of Wall Street institutional phase, which I don't think we should be too averse to, because at a minimum, it will make Bitcoin more liquid, kind of more regulated. Some people might not like that, some people might. So that's kind of the near-term future, and who knows what that will bring. That'll be a case where we have to be hyper-vigilant as Bitcoiners to make sure that the, you know, the big custodians are behaving well. And then we're going to have a civil war, probably, over the fungibility of Bitcoin. I don't think Bitcoin will ever get confidential transactions, but we'll have a war between the factions that want Bitcoin to be fully transparent and audited and so on, you know, with the chain analysis companies, and the people that want the base layer to become a massive CoinJoin TumbleBit transaction that want to enhance privacy at the very base layer. I don't know. Maybe that won't come to pass. That's just something I've been thinking about a lot recently.
I've been thinking about that a lot. It's come up in a couple of my conversations recently, actually. I had a chat with Jimmy Song, and we were talking about the recent bug on Bitcoin. And we discussed whether a fully private based layer would therefore hide any exploitation of an inflation bug.
Yeah. Huge, huge concern.
Yeah. And then secondly, when I was discussing it with Safe Dean and Caitlin Long, that to hold Wall Street accountable, to ensure there's no fractional reserve Bitcoin, you would need an open ledger. With a private ledger, you wouldn't be able to confirm this. Therefore, you know, because when I first got into Bitcoin, I was under the belief, like most people, it was anonymous. And it was only when chain analysis came out, a few kind of examples, that we all realized it isn't anonymous. So I was thinking, okay, privacy is cool. But now I'm starting to see the arguments against it. I think I'm edging towards against a fully private Bitcoin. I think if you want full privacy, you have Monero, you have other options. Where are you?
I had the same journey. I had exactly the same journey. You probably came around faster than me. The toughest part for me was looking at how big Monero transactions are from a kilobyte perspective. They're pretty large. That is a huge scalability loss. And the unprunability also kind of sucks there. So there's that just kind of technical constraint. And then you're absolutely right. I've begun to see Bitcoin's transparency as a virtue. And many Bitcoiners won't like that. But that's because I think that the very base layer will be used for huge settlement transactions between the kind of intermediaries that we then subsequently rely on. And, you know, maybe the intermediaries are just Lightning wallets, so they don't necessarily have to be third parties. They can be controlled by us. But then you get your private transacting at the subsequent higher, like, levels and layers. So Lightning gives us more private transactions. So that's kind of the equivalent of petty cash, physical transactions, which are, you know, extremely private in nature. And it's okay that they're private because they're smaller. So that's my view. I think auditing the holdings of large exchanges is absolutely paramount. And I'm surprised that there hasn't been more of a focus on this. And I mean, even today, you know, I've been monitoring the Bitfinex premium and the, you know, potential Tether crisis and so on. And you can look at the Bitfinex cold wallet and see the outflows there. And the other side of that equation is just getting an attestation for Bitfinex saying we have this many customer deposits, and then assuming you trust them, you can actually audit the whole system. That's beautiful. We don't have that in, like, conventional finance. That's something new and interesting. So I think we should probably try to preserve that. So I do think it's very unlikely we'll get, like, confidential transactions to the base layer, like, anytime soon.
It was only when it was explained to me, like, by Safe Dean, when he talked about that you need to be able to audit these institutions. You need to be able to hold them accountable. And if you don't have a public ledger, you can't do this. So, no, I'm fully with you. What else do you think is important? What else do you think is required?
For Bitcoin long-term, or?
Yeah, over the next 10 years.
Yeah, so privacy enhancements at the transactional layer, I think, would be useful. But yeah, I would say, just generally speaking, sort of the near-term improvements we've been looking at, like Schnorr, would be very welcome, but not required. And I would say, in terms of infrastructure or operating businesses, one thing I've been saying a lot recently is just a more diverse set of exchanges. In particular, like peer-to-peer exchanges, exchanges that can't necessarily easily be shut down by the state, right? So if Coinbase, you know, ever found that kind of initial hacker rebellious nature, and they started facilitating demonetization event in some country, let's just say Argentina, that wanted to shift entirely, you know, a significant fraction of the population wanted to shift to Bitcoin, the Argentine government could just shut down the Coinbase's branches in that country, and that would be that. So I think if we ever do want to enable people worldwide to get access to Bitcoin in a demonetization event, like a Bitcoinization event, you know, like we had dollarization events, for that to be a real thing that could possibly occur, we need Bitcoin to be super liquid, obviously, and able to absorb that without too much of a market impact. But we also need intermediaries that can make that happen. And I'm thinking about like money changers that can easily issue vouchers for fiat on the street. I know there's a couple of projects that are thinking about doing this. Azteco is one of them. That's the kind of thing that needs to exist for this to even be possible. That needs to be widespread, and you know, I think we're still some ways away from that infrastructure being a reality too.
And my last question relates to mining. Somebody asked, well, quite an aggressive tweet today about mining. This is to me and Ryan Selkis regarding the centralization of mining in China and how this is a huge risk for Bitcoin. Yet it doesn't seem to be something that hugely concerns well-versed Bitcoiners, articulate people like yourself. How do you feel about mining at the moment? And how do you feel about the fact that four of the six pools are in China?
Pools I'm not worried about, because pools consist of individuals who can withdraw their hash power at any time. So the supposed pool ability to influence Bitcoin is minimal. If a pool starts misbehaving, the contributors of that pool would leave. So I think it's like borderline fallacious to look at pools as single power structures. They are just repositories for many, many single decision makers. So that's that. I was definitely concerned that there would be a single monopolist manufacturer of ASICs, because then they could, in theory, be compromised in some way. Maybe the Chinese government could pressure them into inserting a backdoor, which, you know, and then a bug, which would be difficult to recover from. And, you know, many of us predicted this as well, that mining hardware would become more commoditized, that industry would become more competitive, which is just the normal thing that happens to firms and markets where margins are very wide and barriers to entry are low, or medium, I'd say, in hardware manufacturing biz. That happened. So Bitmain's advantage was definitely eroded. Their best chipmaker team left. Now you have WhatsMiner, Ebang, Avalon, Bitmain all competing. So it's, you know, not perfect, of course, but the hardware market is definitely becoming more and more decentralized. It doesn't need to be perfectly decentralized. All you need is that there are a bunch of hardware manufacturers. It's not dominated by a single entity. As far as the actual locations of the Bitcoin mines goes, yeah, I would say that's actually a concern. I don't believe that we've invented a better system than proof of work yet, so I don't think it's kind of existential concern or reason to move over to something else. Like, if the choice is between somewhat jurisdictionally exposed proof of work and a pure politics game delegated proof of stake, I can tell you what I prefer. So it's all about trade-offs, right? You can't just look at these things in isolation. And, you know, I think China's hostility to Bitcoin has meant that a lot of miners actually migrated out of there. It's hard to get data on this because miners don't like to say where they are or what they're mining with or what they're doing. So there's no good reliable data on this, but I think we do know that there was an outflow from China for a lot of miners in the last year or so. And I think as we discover, as the mining industry becomes more sophisticated, it will start to uncover these kind of stranded energy assets. So the big mines, which were off the grid, is one case. Now you have cases of solar farms. There's one in Morocco, which is off the grid, which to monetize itself in the early days of its operation, it plans to mine Bitcoin. I don't know if that's actually going to happen or not, but that, there's definitely a Bloomberg article about that. And then you have stuff like Steve Barber's company Upstream Data, which captures methane released by oil wells in Canada. And the methane would otherwise be vented. And what he does is he turns the methane into electricity and then mines totally off the grid with that. So, you know, this is like the kind of innovative outcome of having a global buyer for energy, which doesn't care about your actual jurisdiction. What you have is these stranded assets that get unlocked. And I think that's kind of the trend. I'm not saying all Bitcoin is going to be mined with solar. I think that's probably pretty unlikely. But I think that as this industry becomes more sophisticated, you're just going to have these like little patchworks of stranded energy assets, which are like scooped up by Bitcoin, just because people are entrepreneurial and they'll seek that out. So the future for the dispersion of Bitcoin mining, in my view, is very, very bright.
One of the common FUD arguments or counter arguments against Bitcoin is that once the mining reward is gone, will there be enough money in network fees for miners in the future? Or will it require inflation?
I would describe that as quality FUD, you know? It's like, it's not just FUD, it's actually not a bad argument. You know, I think the good news is that everyone is kind of aware of this in Bitcoin land, and we've all committed to the 21 million cap, to the best of my knowledge. I hope we can stick to it. I think everybody sort of believes in that. So we're going to design around that constraint. And if that means we're going to have to pay fees, I think, you know, most Bitcoiners will consider that totally acceptable. And I think the blockchains that have committed to low fees or no fees and believe that they're going to have caps are just going to have some sort of collision there. So Bitcoin Cash, for instance, you know, we need low fees for commerce. We're also going to have a 21 million unit cap. Well, something's going to happen down the line where you can't pay your miners anymore or you become very weak. So they're going to have to reckon with that. Bitcoin will also have that reckoning, but Bitcoin has already bitten the bullet, you know, so to speak, and admitted, okay, fine, we'll have fees. The fees, if you really reason through it, and you look at the capacity Bitcoin can do in terms of payments per day and the size of transactions, I think the picture starts to look a little sunnier. If Bitcoin transactions continue to be very large and has a very large economic throughput, you can afford, if you're paying $10 fees, you know, that looks fairly small relative to a $100,000 transaction. And if you have lots and lots of those large transactions, then you actually do get levels of miner revenue which are comparable to the revenue today, which I think we would agree is pretty safe. It's pretty tough to attack Bitcoin. So, I mean, it does depend on how you define the security model. And there have been some, I won't get into it right now, it's a little complex, but I think you can reason through it in ways that make a lot of sense. The question is then, is block space something that will always be cheap because of the existence of alternative chains that have cheap block space? Or will users be willing to pay a premium to use Bitcoin? And I think that they will, because Bitcoin has this kind of demonstrated record of reliability, uptime. You know, it's been around for 10 years almost to the day. I believe that Bitcoin block space will have a premium and that, you know, we will figure out a way to layer on fees that make sense. But it is still definitely an open question.
Well, I think back in January, was it January or December, I was paying sometimes $30, $40 for Bitcoin transactions and I wasn't too bothered. I mean, it was annoying, but relative to the size of the transaction, it was quite small. I guess it requires a good second layer for the cheaper, smaller transactions and the microtransactions, right?
Yes. The way I think about it is if you have a functional second layer, you can amortize thousands or millions of individual transactions into one super large settlement transactions. And then the per fee, you know, the per transaction fees start to look really small, even though the base layer transaction did have high fees.
So if you got a new Medium post or a presentation coming?
Nothing as well, you know, sufficiently developed. Take a little break from the blog post for now. But it's definitely something I'm thinking about. I think Bitcoiners should trust that people smarter than myself are also thinking about this too. So it's not that core devs have abandoned the concept of the fee market. It's just something that's being pondered right now.
I think we've done our hour, Nick. It's pretty good. Probably one of the most articulate interviews I've had. To close out, can you just tell us again who you want to hear from, how they can get in touch, and what's coming up for you?
Yeah, so if you are building on Bitcoin or just building something for public blockchains or even a completely tangential business and you are raising a seed round or an A, please get in touch. Castle Island Ventures wants to talk with you. You can find me on Twitter. My DMs are always open. I would be really happy to hear you out. And what's coming up for me is more of the same. So more being obnoxious on Twitter and more kind of Medium posts and more data, of course. And we have big plans for Coin Metrics too.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for coming on, Nick. And hopefully we'll see you soon. And if I ever get to Boston, you can take me to see the Red Sox.
I certainly will. Thank you so much for having me, Peter.
Okay, so what did you make of that? Nick is pretty interesting, right? Very articulate, probably one of the smartest people I've had on the show. I'll confess, I had to Google some of the things he talked about to find out what they were. I'd never heard of a cargo cult. Maybe I should have. Yeah, it was great to have him on. I also really enjoy Nick's writing. I really enjoy Nick's presentations. I recommend you go and check him out on Medium. You follow him. All links to that are in the show notes. He writes in a very, very interesting way. And I also love the way he looks at data. So yes, I'm very grateful to Nick for coming on the show to talk through a few of the things that I'm questioning, I'm not sure about. Who knows, maybe in 10 years, Bitcoin will be the only
only surviving blockchain, or maybe there will be a number of blockchains creating value. I've got no idea, but it is definitely interesting trying to find out and trying to see where this space will go. So please support the show. Please consider becoming a patron. Head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. Please leave me a review on iTunes, 5-star if you think it deserves it, and also subscribe on iTunes. Please follow me on social media. I'm at whatbitcoindid on everything: Twitter, Instagram, Medium. Please check out my website, which is www.whatbitcoindid.com. Sign up to my email list, and please share this out with your friends and family. And if you want to get in touch, if you've got any questions, feel free to reach out to me. I do reply pretty much to everyone, and my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. I have 3 interviews being conducted next week, preparing to go to Twice Weekly. One of them is an absolute cracker, so I'm looking forward to getting that out. Okay, I hope you all have a great weekend, and I will see you next week.